Welcome to the Science Podcast for October 26, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Edward Hermy. This week, swaying politics through social media, science in the U.S. elections, and why we're interested in the shoulder blades of ancient humans.
Vertebrate anatomists, vertebrate paleontologists have been looking at the scapula and been able to predict an animal's locomotor preference pretty closely.
Plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Campaign ads on TV, newspapers, radio, and the web all aim to sway voters, often with overt messages plugging their side and digging the other. On social media, things can be more subtle. I spoke with Takis Metaxas about the introduction of political propaganda through social media's back door.
You see, more of us use social media these days, and we also rely on them more and more to get informed. However, manipulation of social media affects our perception of electoral candidates. The vast majority of people using social media are just not aware of this manipulation. As a result, our decision-making can be compromised, especially at the polls.
So, as you say, there are propagandists or people who have political motivations trying to influence us through social media.
Yeah.
Can you give some examples from social sites like Facebook or Twitter?
Yes, of course. One common way of manipulation is through our perception of popularity of candidates through the social media. So we tend to think that if a candidate is more popular in, say, Facebook, or if he has more friends and likes than his opponent, then he probably has a greater chance of being elected. These numbers do not really represent a random sample of the likely voters by any means, and they get manipulated. Here is an example. A few weeks ago, it was reported that Governor Romney's Twitter followers increased in a single day by over 100,000. You know, when people took a closer look at it, these sudden followers, they realized that they were mostly fake. They were automatically generated by computer programs.
Well, you also talk about a few methods that involve not necessarily straight-up social sites like Facebook, but more about search engines, which everybody uses.
Yeah, search engines play a very important role in our life. The Pew Foundation is making measurements of how we're using search engines for a long time, and we know that these days, for example, 2 out of 3 adults use search engines in America every day. Ah. The other interesting piece of data is that more than 70% of these people believe that most or all the time, the information they find is accurate and trustworthy. There is no doubt at all that search engines are doing an amazing job in finding information. But it is also true that the results can be manipulated, and that's something that's not widely known. So in particular, if you search for political candidates in the past, you may have found entries in the top 10 results that they would not have ranked so high if they were not manipulated. For example, there were Google bombs in 2006 that they were the outcome of such manipulation. I'm not sure if people are familiar with it. It's a Google bomb.
Why don't you explain what a Google bomb is?
Yeah, it's the act of associating a term with the web page through the use of the text that you're writing in the web page. So an example would be the association of the term miserable failure that was done for joke in the past, initially with the page of President Bush, then Hillary Clinton, Michael Moore, etc. So these were done for fun, but in 2006, there were more focused Google bombs on congressional candidates trying to associate their names with negative terms. Uh-huh. So the search engines have taken note of it, and since 2008, we have observed that they have tried to restrict the at least top 5 results to official sites, like their official website, their campaign site, Wikipedia entries, etc. Because of these actions, it's less likely that we will see Google bombs in these elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, so candidates and campaigns can actually pay to have search results, at least in Google, at the top of the list, not necessarily in the main part of the page. So how is what they're doing here in Google and other search engines and in social media different than just paying for advertising?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Advertising, of course, is a form of propaganda by itself. You see, what happens is that each one of us maintains a mental network of people, ideas, organizations, and we associate them with some trust value. That's how we know who to trust and who not to trust. The question we answer every time we're thinking of a person or an idea is, how much do we trust this person's opinion on different issues, say related to politics, gardening, to fashion, whatever. Mm-hmm. What advertisers and propagandists both try to do is to alter our personal trust network in ways that benefit them. The important difference, which is what you ask, is misinformation, which is important when it comes from trusted sources. So, like humans, search engines maintain their own trust network, and we call it the web graph. This is the graph that one can see by traversing every web page on the web using the hyperlinks. So propagandists try to manipulate pieces of the web graph in such a way that will make the search engine hire their own content more than they should otherwise. And since we trust the search engines, as we have seen, they're more likely to influence our decisions at the end. Search engines have tried to counter this over the years, and they have made great progress. But in social media, where everybody is an author, and where information is added continuously and in huge volumes, it's much more difficult for each one of us to detect what is true in a short period of time. But there are also some good news, and that has to do with the fact that we are a big crowd out there that is communicating. Research shows that while both truth and lie propagate in social media, it appears that lies have shorter and more questioned lives. Hmm. More people are likely to see something that does not sound right, and it is easier to voice your opinion on social media. When enough critically thinking people hear your lie, then it will not last for too long.
So you've kind of been talking about some numbers here, the percentage of people that believe what they see at the top of their search results, and other kinds of studies about how lies and truth fare on social media. But what about, you know, can you measure the effect that these people who are trying to influence political opinions on social media have? Is this something that has actually been determined to be effective?
Yeah, we can measure some of it. Definitely not the whole extent, but in specific cases, once you start paying attention, you can measure it. For example, we are familiar with an early attempt of what we call a Twitter bomb that was sent out a few days before the Massachusetts special elections in 2010. The Twitter bomb is an unsolicited message sent en masse to Twitter users, either by what we call bots, these are computer programs, or by friends of their users who were fooled or agree with the message. So that Twitter bomb tried to spread misinformation about one of the senatorial candidates, Martha Coakley. There were several interesting aspects of this attempt. First, it was a very low-budget effort, just a few hours of programming, which makes it very attractive to anybody who wants to influence people, right? Mm-hmm. It was launched by a group that operated in Iowa while the elections were in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. so this kind of boundaries do not apply anymore. It managed to send about 1,000 messages from 9 fake accounts, but with the help of likely-minded or fooled people, reached 60,000 accounts within a day.
They were able to target people in Massachusetts?
Yeah. At that time, I'm not sure if all of them were targeted in Massachusetts, but they were able definitely to explore a large group in a short period of time at a crucial time.
But were you able to complete the circle? So you knew that they wrote a program, you knew what the message was, you knew the number of people that they reached, but do you know if those people were actually influenced by this message?
No, of course we cannot do that. We cannot go out and measure each one of them. We know, however, that if one retweeted that message, very likely this person agreed with that message.
Oh, so it's like an upvote.
Right. So we can at least count that many people who at least agreed with the message. Mm-hmm. I do not know if they changed their opinion.
So let's talk a little bit about international politics. I mean, we've talked a lot about the U.S. election that's coming up and other studies that have been done here, but is this kind of approach being taken in non-English-speaking parts of the web?
Yes, of course. You see, social media have shown that they can help organize and excite people, even as they start revolutions. It is not that they cause them, but it is definitely something that helps people organize at that time. So we know a lot of people used social media during the Arab Spring, for example. So propagandists see the opportunity to influence the public, especially at times of social unrest, fear, etc. We also saw it happening during the London riots last year, and actually that was measured, and that's also where people figure out how much these messages propagated. But I believe that things improve, because, as I said, social media allow both truth and lie to propagate, but when enough critically thinking people question the lies, eventually it will be revealed.
Well, Takis Metaxas, thanks so much for talking with me.
I appreciate your interest.
Takis Metaxas and co-author write about Twitter bombs and social media manipulation in a perspective This Week in Science.
Unlike all other primates, humans are not particularly skilled at climbing. In our evolutionary descent to walking on 2 feet, our ancestors left the trees to the birds and the monkeys. But pinning down exactly when that happened and which ancestral species stopped climbing has not been easy. David Green and colleagues provide some insight into this discussion by analyzing the shoulder blades of Australopithecus afarensis fossils and revealing characteristics seen in climbing primates. I spoke with Green from his office at Midwestern University.
Bipedalism is the hallmark of our lineage. It's how we've grown to define what is a hominin or a hominid versus a fossil or an individual that would be more closely related to living apes. And so there's been several theories put forth as to why we left the trees or why bipedalism arose and why it became our main and only form of locomotion. In fact, we're pretty unique in the primate community that we only practice one form of locomotion. And so some of the theories is that, you know, the environment was changing at about the time when our lineage split from chimps. And so possibly the amount of trees that were available was starting to become fractioned. And so food resources were fractioned. And so that encouraged us to basically explore other resources, namely those that were on the ground. And so bipedalism, which may have arisen in the trees as a foraging strategy, may have been the precursor for then locomoting that way while on the ground. So some of the obvious advantages for tree climbing for hominid are foraging. Our dentition and our feeding apparatus is evolved for fruits. It's a highly nutritious source. So trees are an obvious way for us to access those. But even if you think about, if we, I guess, fast forward from the split between chimps and humans and we think about Australopithecus afarensis, this was a very small-bodied group, and they were sharing the landscape with some pretty frightening predators. And so it was an obvious way to protect themselves, particularly at night when a lot of these predators are hunting.
So how did you go about showing that this species, Australopithecus afarensis, was adept at climbing? What was your methodology?
We focused on the shoulder blade, the scapula, and the scapula as a predictor of locomotor behaviors is actually a pretty good predictor, at least among primates, but also across mammals. Vertebrate anatomists, vertebrate paleontologists have been looking at the scapula and been able to predict an animal's locomotor preference pretty closely, and that's true for primates and certainly among higher primates, the hominoids, great apes, and humans. And so that's where we focused, and once the scapulae started coming out, once we were able to see them and had both of them and they were complete, it was an obvious choice because we could compare their scapulae with those of closely related organisms. And the fact that it was a juvenile gave us the added ability to look at certain questions and investigate certain questions related to growth and development.
Yeah. So focusing on development, you actually had this remarkable instance where you had a juvenile and an adult. What in particular did you actually find out by looking at their development?
It's interesting that we had a juvenile, and in fact the juvenile is in better shape than some of the adults, which is ironic, but we have a complete juvenile and we have several fragmentary adults, and so we have two endpoints essentially. It would be nice to have more, but that's always what we're complaining about and wishing for more fossils. But at least we can get a sense. And so our comparative study, which normally comparative studies are comparing adult individuals because they've completed their growth and we can look at their morphology as a more static item. But the growth kind of adds another wrinkle, but it's an interesting wrinkle because we can say, well, does the scapula change throughout development? You know, if we have a snapshot of the morphology of a three-year-old, is it going to be basically just a blown-up version when it's an adult, or are we going to see differences in the proportions, differences in the angles that the joints and the different borders make with one another? And for some of the traits that we looked at, the shoulder joint, which is the glenohumeral joint, that's where the shoulder blade meets our upper arm. Mm-hmm. We also looked at the orientation of the scapular spine is actually something that most people can actually feel on themselves. It's the bony projection off of the shoulder blade. And the orientation that that scapular blade makes kind of tells you the orientation of two of the four rotator cuff muscles, the supraspinatus, which literally means above the spine, and the infraspinatus, which means below the spine. And so we can compare how those proportions change throughout development and also how the different orientations change. And in the African apes, we noticed that they didn't really change that dramatically for some of those traits, whereas in humans, they did change dramatically. And so we compared the baby from Ethiopia, Australopithecus afarensis Salaam, and we compared that with adults like Lucy and a few others that we had, and we found that they also were very similar, so that was more like the African ape.
So when you're comparing this scapular structure to apes or to other hominids or to humans, how do you know what's an adaptation versus what's a relic of their evolution?
Well, that's a good question. That's a big problem that we encounter. And it's something that folks have been debating long before I even started looking into these questions. Namely, at the same time, we have lots of evidence that our hominin ancestors are adapting and evolving to life on the ground and evolving bipedal traits. And so we obviously don't know what the common ancestor of chimps and humans necessarily looked like or how they behaved, how they locomoted. But we can be reasonably sure that they were probably climbing because most primates climb, and especially all of the non-human hominoids climb.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is that if we see any signatures for climbing behaviors, it's difficult to differentiate what is adapted versus what is, like you said, a relic or a primitive retention. And so one of the things that we had at our disposal, other than the fact that the scapula, we know it's a reliable marker, was that chimps and gorillas are known to change their locomotor habits as they develop. So young chimps and young gorillas climb a lot more than adults. Adults are primarily knuckle walking when they're on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found that in addition to some of the traits that remain the same, we saw other traits, and these were the traits that had to do with the blade itself. And we noticed that those traits actually changed in a way that can track the behavioral changes that have been observed by primatologists. And so this gave us some insight that these traits in particular might be particularly reliable for determining if a feature we see in fossils is a good indicator of behavior or if it's just a, you know, as what we call phylogenetic baggage or evolutionary baggage.
So besides the fact that all of these hominid species are long extinct, what are some of the other challenges and limits you have to studying climbing in these hominids?
Well, we have characteristics that we exploit today, but are not necessarily anything that is unique to our species. We have five fingers and we have an opposable thumb. And sure, those are derivations from earlier ancestor, but all primates have opposable thumbs. So Where do we draw the line? And so some of the things that help us determine if a feature we see in a hominin is something that's giving us a reliable indicator of function versus something that might just be the fact that it's a primate, have to do with looking at development and seeing how the behavior changes and seeing if this trait will actually track these changes. There are some features, like the glenohumeral joint that I discussed in chimps, that didn't really change from young individuals to old individuals. So that might be a feature that's just kind of locked. It's like a genetic feature that really remains unchanged. But the fact that certain blade characteristics did vary, it gives us some indication that these might be giving us a reliable snapshot of what this individual was doing at that moment before it died. And there are some other experimental studies that have gone on with just actually examining how bone responds to different exercise or behavioral parameters, and that gives us some insight into how bones in general respond. It does give us some more tools in our toolkit for trying to reconstruct these behavioral patterns in animals and in individuals. We don't have the ability to observe them in the wild anymore.
Well, David Green, thanks so much for talking with me.
Sure. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
David Green and colleagues describe the morphology of a juvenile hominid's shoulder blade and its possible function in climbing in this week's issue.
When it comes to science and research, the road ahead of the U.S. president-to-be is fraught with potholes in the form of budget woes, controversial funding decisions, and a Congress that's hard to please. Carrie Klein spoke with science news writer David Malakoff about the scientific pledges of the two main candidates and the challenges that lie in wait, no matter who wins the vote.
Both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama have said that funding basic research is an important role for government because that's the kind of research that companies are unlikely to fund, private industry is unlikely to fund. So they do see an important role for the federal government in supporting very fundamental studies.
And what do their track records say? Have they been consistent in their support of science in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think both of these guys recognize that scientific research, innovation, commercialization of new technologies are, you know, essentially the core of the American strength in the world economy. And so they don't want to see us give up that strength.
So they both support science. Do we have anything to worry about?
Well, it depends on who you are. Regardless of who's elected to be the next president, they face some really daunting financial issues. And those financial issues are going to color every decision that's made about research and development investment by the federal government. So really, they're going to come in, they're going to have to deal with the so-called fiscal cliff, this enormous deal on taxes and spending that's going to have to be reached. Once the overall level of government spending is agreed on, they're going to have to agree on what their priorities are. And that's a place where you're going to see some differences. These two candidates have said they have different priorities.
Can you give me a couple of examples where they may have their priorities aligned differently?
Sure. Yeah. So one big one is energy. For example, the Obama administration has felt very strongly that the government needs to move very aggressively to move new technologies into the energy marketplace, particularly energy technologies that are not fossil fuel based, so low carbon technologies, solar, wind, things like that. And they've put a lot of money into sort of nudging along very late stage technologies, which may not be quite ready for the market, but they want to push them in. And the problem with that is they've had loan guarantee programs and investments that have done very poorly. So you've had the bankruptcy of Solyndra and other companies and things like that. Romney has said that is absolutely not a role that the federal government should be playing. It should not be picking winners and losers in the energy marketplace. So he would swing the portfolio much more towards basic research. However, there is one place where the two candidates agree. They both very much like this Department of Energy program called ARPA-E, which is the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, which sort of takes a venture capital approach, but is also very quickly to kill off late stage technologies that don't appear to be making the transition to commercial use.
Okay, well, let's move into another sector where their platforms are relatively similar, and that's biomedicine, things like stem cell research, cancer research. You know, what have the two candidates pledged?
Well, you know, biomedical research has long had very strong bipartisan support. The National Institutes of Health in Republican administrations and Democratic administrations has done very well. Now, the reality is, given our current financial situation, NIH may not be able to grow as fast as it has grown in the past, and it may indeed even see potentially real cuts. But I think you have two candidates who have repeatedly said they see a very important role for the government in funding basic biomedical research. And quite frankly, politically, if they didn't say that, they're going to face a lot of pressure from patient advocacy groups and health research advocacy groups. So I think biomedical research is one of the areas that I think will do well under either candidate.
Absolutely. And they've both got personal experience with cancer in particular.
That's right. And they both bring, you know, personal experience. They have spouses, family members. Every politician themselves or has a family member who suffers from some health issue. And so they're very interested.
Well, then let's move into a subject where there is a lot more contrast between the two candidates, an issue that's particularly polarizing, and that's climate and the environment. So what are some issues there that really hinge on who is elected in November?
Yeah, this is an area where if you're looking for stark contrasts, at least rhetorically, you're going to find them very quickly. So on one hand, you have President Obama, who has, you know, forcefully said humans are causing climate change, for example. He believes the federal government has an important role to play in reducing emissions, worked a little bit to get legislation through Congress, ultimately failed in that. On the other hand, Romney has been much less interested in this issue. He says, yes, humans appear to be contributing to the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but he really has said, let's do some more study and think about this. But more importantly, he's really flat out said there is not an important federal role here to curb emissions. He says, you know, even if it were feasible, it may well be too damaging to the economy to be a priority for the United States right now. Now, the question is, will those differences make a real difference in the next term? Because on one hand, although Obama has strongly supported addressing climate change, he has not been able to bring the rest of the political structure along with him. The White House can do a few things on their own, executive orders, things like that. You know, on the other hand, Romney has said, you know, he doesn't really plan to do anything. But a year into the next president's new term, they are going to be confronted with the next report from the International Panel on Climate Change, which probably is going to remind people that this is a real problem. And so whoever's in the White House is going to have to at least talk about it again.
Right. Well, I think you bring up an interesting point, which is that, you know, wherever these candidates stand, they're not going to be able to implement the changes that they're proposing probably as quickly or as effectively as they actually are promising.
Right. No president unilaterally can move as fast or as far as they want to on environmental issues. And that's because these issues are caught up in this very complicated web that's created by legislation and by litigation and by very entrenched interest groups. So Obama came in. He wanted to move very quickly, for example, to improve protection of habitat on federal lands, things like that. But these tend to be fairly slow processes. Romney, on the other hand, has promised to undo many of the regulations that the Obama administration has put in place, mm-hmm. for example, to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act, to crack down on mercury emissions, crack down on ground-level ozone emissions. But Romney, too, will face a very difficult legal and political environment if he simply tries to roll these things back. It will probably take some time. He can certainly slow some things down, but he may not be able to kill them outright.
Well, all right. So what we've been talking about are a couple of short articles that are all part of a News Focus package this week on science and the elections. So can you just give me a quick rundown of what else is covered in this package?
Yeah. So we try to take a look at how the two candidates would address things like defense research, energy research, climate and the environment, as we talked about it, how they think about biomedical research, how they think about the space program, human spaceflight versus more robotic missions, what's going to happen with exploration of Mars. These are all questions that the new president is going to have to face. We also have another story that takes a look at one congressional race. Congress obviously plays a big role in all these decisions. Turns out there's one very interesting congressional race where a PhD physicist is running against a 7-term congresswoman who's been quite a big supporter of science. And so actually science policy figures in this House race, which is pretty unusual. And we also have a very interesting look by Elliot Marshall at the scholarship around negative advertising and the question of, does negative advertising, for example, depress the number of people who turn out at the polls, or does it actually enhance the number of people who want to vote because it gets them all stirred up? So there's some interesting study around that.
Indeed. Well, David Malikoff, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
David Malikoff and other news writers discuss science and the U.S. elections in a series of News Focus articles this week.
Finally today, I'm here with science staff writer Carolyn Grambling, who's here to give us a rundown on some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. First up, we have a story on the history of orchids and art. So, orchids are all the rage now, but when did people first start to feature orchids in art?
Yes, so in modern times, people are very passionate about orchids, both because they're really beautiful, they've spawned this multi-billion dollar industry of trade, but also because they have had this very symbolic representation because of their resemblance to both male and female organs. People have really seen them as signs of fertility, and they've been, you know, abundantly represented in paintings. And people have been tracing that representation in art as far back as the Italian Renaissance. And so one question, however, was, you know, was this actually the earliest appearance of these flowers in art? We've abundantly studied their biology and their ecology, but we really didn't know very much about their appearance in art, which there's actually a term for. It's called phytoiconography.
Interesting. So these phytoiconographers, what did they actually find by looking back at ancient art?
So this one botanist was very interested to sort of trace how far back the depictions of these flowers went. And she started amassing this large database of Italian paintings and sculptures and other types of art, and then tried to connect the flowers that were seen in those artistic works with actual flowers in real life. And what they found, to their surprise, was that some much more ancient pieces of art actually showed depictions of orchids. Mm-hmm. And some of these depictions went as far back as Roman times to just after 0 BCE.
And so why do they think these Roman artworks were featuring orchids? What do they think was the significance?
Well, the symbolism of orchids probably was very similar back then to what it is now, in the sense that because of their very strong resemblance to the male and female organs, they probably represented fertility for them. And what's interesting, though, is that there does seem to be a gap between their depictions back in Roman times. There were many centuries when they were not actually appearing in works of art at all, and not again until the Italian Renaissance.
So, yeah, why did this orchid craze seem to fade?
Well, one theory for this, of course we can't actually know, but one theory is that when the Christian era became dominant, that actually really put a damper on people's enthusiasm for representing these flowers in art because of their association with sexuality.
So from recognizing flowers and artwork, our next study looks at how the brain recognizes faces. So what do we know about how the brain does this complex task?
Well, we've done a number of imaging studies that show regions of the brain that are associated that, you know, respond when people are responding to faces. And there's actually a part of the brain that's called the fusiform gyrus, and that people have associated for some time with facial recognition, but they didn't actually know how it's involved in that or how significant this region is to facial recognition.
Mm-hmm. So there was this correlation of activity in the fusiform gyrus, but so far there wasn't really any indicator that this was actually super important.
Right.
How did the researchers get around this challenge?
Well, they actually had the opportunity to work with somebody, a very intrepid patient who came to them. So this was sort of a lucky break for them. There was an engineer who suffered from epilepsy, and he came to Stanford University to get treatment for his seizures. He had found that as a child, he was on medication that seemed to help, but as he got older, medication became less and less effective. So he was hoping for treatment, and his doctor suggested that they might be able to eliminate the seizures by opening up his brain and surgically destroying a very tiny area of brain tissue where they happened.
Wow.
So they placed electrodes on his brain, and they were trying to stimulate his brain to figure out where the seizures were originating from. And what they found was actually, to their surprise, when they stimulated a certain region of the brain, instead of having the seizures, what happened was that he looked at the doctor and he said, "Your face is all metamorphosed." And then when they stopped stimulating those electrodes in that region, he said, "Well, your face went back to normal."
Mm-hmm.
So they knew something was going on there.
So now there's a potentially causal relationship between this specific brain area and identifying faces.
Yes, there were two spots where these two electrodes were that actually stimulated the faces. And what was interesting was, instead of being able to see anything else in a distorted way, it only distorted the faces. So he would look at objects that they looked normal to him. But when he looked at the face of the doctor or of his assistant, those looked metamorphosed for some reason.
And finally, we go from the function of our brain to an article that looks at how we got such a big brain in the first place. So what do these researchers suggest was a factor in the evolution of our large brains?
Well, we know that we have significantly more neurons than any other primate. We have about 86 billion neurons on average, compared with about 33 billion neurons in gorillas and 28 billion in chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
So we know we have this many neurons. And of course, we know that these neurons endow us with many benefits, but they do come at a price. And that price is that when we're at rest, our body consumes 20% of its energy, compared with about 9% for these other primates. So that extra energy has to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how is it that we were able to fuel our brains enough to support this extra brain power?
Mm-hmm. So what's their hypothesis? What's their theory?
Well, one theory that came around in the late 1990s was that because we would have to consume a significant amount of food, how would we ever have the time to be able to do that in order to support our brains? And one theory was cooking might be the secret ingredient, so to speak, in the sense that by cooking, we're essentially pre-digesting our food. We're making it easier for our guts to basically uptake the calories, to absorb the calories, and that that might actually be our secret weapon in terms of being able to eat less or spend less time fueling our bodies.
Mm-hmm. So how did the researchers actually go about testing such a hypothesis, this cooking hypothesis?
Well, so what they did several different things. While this cooking hypothesis had existed, they wanted to take a look at sort of the other side of it and basically say, okay, so supposing that we were to eat only a raw food diet, would there actually be an upper limit on how much our brains could grow based on that diet alone?
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did was they looked at the neurons in humans and other primates, and they were able to link brain size both to the number of neurons in the brain and then link that number directly to the amount of calories needed to fuel a brain. And then they calculated exactly how much raw food would be needed to fuel a brain of a particular size and with a particular number of neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that basically there is indeed an upper limit to how much primates can grow their brains based on a raw food diet. For humans, we would have to forage 9 hours a day just in order to feed our big brains. And this is at least one more hour a day than for other primate species. So this is a significant more amount of time that we would have to forage.
So this proposes a riddle. Where do ancestors actually get the extra energy needed to begin developing a large brain in the first place?
So that is where the cooking comes in. In order to actually be able to maintain our brain size, one idea is that if we were to cook our food, we would actually be able to consume enough calories and absorb enough calories in our guts in order to be able to fuel our brains without having to sacrifice the extra time needed to forage.
Mm-hmm. So maybe cooking wasn't something that you needed a large brain to invent.
No.
Okay. Another question. How is this possible, though? Because there's a growing trend of people now eating raw food diets. Shouldn't they be starving to death? Are their brains shrinking?
No. And in fact, in a raw food diet, you're actually not just eating raw food that is unprocessed in any way. You're actually processing the food in blenders. You're adding protein and other nutrients. So it is, in fact, already produced in such a way that it will make it easier for our bodies to absorb that extra fuel.
Okay. And Carolyn, what else have we got on the site this week?
Well, for Science Now, we've got a story about using gut bacteria to fight chronic infection. And there's also a story about filament-shaped bacteria and how they can act like electric cables. And for Science Insider, our policy blog, we have our continuing coverage of the sentencing of 6 Italian earthquake experts who were convicted of manslaughter this week, and also how a controversial iron fertilization experiment off the coast of Canada is actually legal but maybe likely to produce very little science. And finally, this week's Science Live is about whether Neanderthals were actually smarter than we give them credit for. So be sure to check all of those things out.
Great. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Carolyn Gramling is a staff writer for Science. You can check out all our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the October 26, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Edward Hermy. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.